Welcome to the second podcast of the Johns Hopkins University Virtual Alumni Book Club for the 2010-2011 academic year. I am your moderator, Jay Lenro, alumnus of the class of 1973 and a vice president of the Hopkins Alumni Council. We are here on a chilly late fall day in the Stephen Muller Building on the Homewood campus, the home of both the Space Telescope Science Institute and the famed Hubble Telescope. It is a particular pleasure to introduce our faculty host, Dr. Mario Livio of the Institute. He will discuss this month's selection, which is his own book, Is God a Mathematician? Dr. Mario Livio is a senior astrophysicist at the Space Telescope Science Institute and head of the Institute's Office of Public Outreach. He joined the Institute in 1991 as head of the Archive Branch and also served as the head of the Institute's Science Division. In addition to his scientific interests, Dr. Livio is a self-proclaimed art fanatic who owns hundreds of art books. During the past few years, he combined his passions for science and art in four popular books: The Accelerating Universe, which discusses the beauty of fundamental theories of the universe; The Golden Ratio, which tells the story of an astonishing number and discusses the beauty of symmetric and simplicity of phi; and The Equation That Couldn't Be Solved, which is the first extensive popular account of group theory, the language of symmetry, and the theory of polynomials. But we are here to discuss his latest book, Is God a Mathematician?, which discusses the question of why mathematics is as powerful as it is in describing things ranging from the laws of nature to the property of ordinary knots. Dr. Livio weaves together science, history, and philosophy, and he has made it his mission in life to explain the science of mathematics in a way that most people can understand and enjoy. Dr. Livio lectures very frequently to the public, including more than 20 full-day seminars to the public at the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C., and he is also interviewed often in the media, which includes two appearances on the CBS program 60 Minutes. Dr. Livio's book, The Golden Ratio, won him the Peano Prize for 2003 and the International Pythagoras Prize for 2004 as the best popular book on mathematics. He is a master at discussing the relationship of mathematics, the cosmos, and the human mind. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Mario Livio. Dr. Livio, if you could, please share two passages that you believe are representative of your writing and discuss why you chose them.
Okay, I'll read three passages, one a little bit longer, two rather short, from the book, Is God a Mathematician? So here is one. There are actually two sides to the success of mathematics in explaining the world around us, a success that Wigner dubbed the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics, one more astonishing than the other. First, there is an aspect one might call active. When physicists wander through nature's labyrinth, they light their way by mathematics. The tools they use and develop, the models they construct, and the explanations they conjure are all mathematical in nature. This, on the face of it, is a miracle in itself. Newton observed a falling apple, the moon, and tides on the beaches. I'm not even sure if he ever saw those. Not mathematical equations. Yet he was somehow able to extract from all of these natural phenomena clear, concise, and unbelievably accurate mathematical laws of nature. But there is also a passive side to the mysterious effectiveness of mathematics, and it is so surprising that the active aspect pales by comparison. Concepts and relations explored by mathematicians only for pure reasons, with absolutely no application in mind, turn out decades or sometimes centuries later to be the unexpected solutions to problems grounded in physical reality. How is that possible? So that's one passage. The second one is the sign outside the barber shop in one village reads, "I shave all and only those men in the village who do not shave themselves." Sounds perfectly reasonable, right? Clearly, the men who shave themselves do not need the services of the barber, and it is only natural for the barber to shave everyone else. But ask yourself, who shaves the barber? If he shaves himself, then according to the sign, he should be one of those he does not shave. On the other hand, if he does not shave himself, then again, according to the sign, he should be one of those he doesn't shave. So does he or doesn't he? Much lesser questions have historically resulted in serious family feuds. And the last paragraph is, philosophy is to be studied not for the sake of any definite answers to its questions, since no definite answers can, as a rule, be known to be true, but rather for the sake of the questions themselves, because these questions enlarge our conception of what is possible, enrich our intellectual imagination, and diminish the dogmatic assurance which closes the mind against speculation. But above all, because through the greatness of the universe which philosophy contemplates, the mind is also rendered great and becomes capable of that union with the universe which constitutes its highest good. Now, why did I choose these passages? Mm-hmm. Well, the first passage really deals with, one of the key questions that the book discusses, namely what Nobel laureate Eugene Wigner termed the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics.
And if you could just, for this, the sake of our listeners, while you're discussing these, just tell them what page in the book these passages are.
This was page 4 in the book. The question is, how come mathematics is as powerful as it is in explaining nature? And I noted here that it is even effective in two ways. One is when you actually see the phenomena, and then you try to find a mathematical theory to explain those phenomena. But second thing is when mathematicians are, doing something with absolutely no application whatsoever in mind. In fact, they are proud that there are no applications, because that's what mathematicians like to do. And yet, somehow, decades later, those very precise mathematical branches are found to provide the answers to questions that, are really, explain phenomena that we observe. The second paragraph that I read is on page 172. And it starts the chapter on logic and reasoning. And that is actually known as the barber's paradox. And it was designed originally by Bertrand Russell. And the idea was to demonstrate that our logic can be fallible. Things that look perfectly reasonable may result in paradoxes or contradictions, self-contradictions. And the last paragraph I read, which is actually the very last paragraph of the book on page 252, is actually a quote from Russell again in his book, The Problems of Philosophy. And the reason I chose that is because it really, in a way, sums up the main reason why somebody should read this book, that the question is more important than the answer. I mean, people ask me often, so what's the answer to is God a mathematician? I say, well, it's not a simple yes or no. So that sort of describes very nicely, in my opinion, this general attitude that I have towards this book, that it's the question that matters.
What seemed important to me in reading your book is how you get people in popular culture, people who are not mathematicians, not scientists, to start thinking of math in a significantly different light. We have a problem probably in this country where mathematics is considered by many something too difficult to understand, too difficult to do. We see falling numbers of students in math, science, and engineering in our schools. What I think for our readers is going to be particularly interesting is the way you demystify mathematics. And it's been interesting also to see how math has been treated in the last 10, 15 years in some popular culture. And I know my children and loved watching a recent television series called Numbers. And it showed how a mathematician was using math to explain what seemed to be random events. So could you explore a little bit more of how you've approached that and what you see your research and writing doing to explain math and demystify popular culture?
So I think you touched on something that's very important. You noted that there is a great decrease in people going into what we call STEM disciplines, which is, you know, science and technology, engineering and mathematics. And this is actually a serious problem for this country. It has always been somewhat of a problem, but the problem has become more acute, and it is, the future is in these disciplines. I mean, for countries to be successful in the future, you need to have enough people that work in these disciplines. And this country used to depend to some extent on immigration to actually fill some of those gaps, in the sense that you would have had, let's say, students from China or from India coming here, doing here their PhD in these disciplines, mathematics, the sciences, and staying here. What has happened in recent years is, number one, the immigration laws became more difficult, so it is more difficult for people to immigrate here. And second, as those countries, you know, China, Korea, India, are actually developing themselves, what happens now very often is that people come here, they do their PhD here, and they go back. Mm-hmm. They no longer stay here. And since it has never been the case that working in mathematics or the sciences, that's the easiest way to become rich, then this is a problem, and this is definitely a developing problem. I see part of my task. I mean, I enjoy writing these books for many reasons, but at least I hope that by demystifying mathematics and by making it a part of human culture as opposed to some, you know, obscure science, I hope that I encourage more people to actually get into this and see the beauty that is involved in studying sciences and mathematics. If I've managed to convince at least a few people to do this based on reading my books, then I achieved a very big goal.
As I said, and you agree, pop culture has probably added to this sense of mystery behind science and math. Is there some way that the readers can extrapolate from your book in their own discussions or in the discussions in their wider community outside of this book club in helping promote the teaching of science and math?
Well, one thing that everybody should realize, and I hope that, you know, this book also makes clear, as did some of my previous books, is that mathematics is all around us. I mean, even in areas that you don't think about them as, you know, involving mathematics, I mean, mathematics is heavily involved. I mean, let me give you a very simple example. I mean, everybody now uses a GPS, be it in their cars, in their wherever, you know, and so on. They have it in their phones, and so on. This is a global positioning system, yes? The global positioning system works in the following way. I mean, basically, there is a receiver, which is the thing you have, and there are some satellites out there, mm-hmm. and the system uses the time it takes the signal to reach from those satellites to your receiver to actually locate where you are, and this is how it directs you to the, where you want to go.
Triangulation.
So it triangulates on several satellites. Now, you may not know this, but actually in this system, both Einstein's theory of special relativity and Einstein's theory of general relativity are being used. Because the atomic clocks on board the satellites, they actually, because those satellites are moving, they tick a little bit more slowly, by about a few millionths of a second per day, just because of special relativity. And they tick by a few tenths of millionths of a second faster every day, just because the satellites are farther away from the Earth. And if those two corrections of special relativity and general relativity, both highly mathematical theories of physics, yes, were not used, the accumulated error could be as much as about 5 miles per day to where you are, which means you would have never gotten to anywhere, you know, if you didn't use these two mathematical theories. Now, people don't think about this, and they shouldn't, in a way. But, I mean, mathematics is in everything around you. And, you know, this book tries to deal with the nature of mathematics and how come it is as effective as it is, you know, and so on and so forth. So I hope that people who read this will get this sense.
And I know there's an attempt to show even young children some of the beauty of mathematics and science. As simple as looking at different patterns from snowflakes,
right,
or the vein patterns in a leaf, and I'm reminded of a funny story. When I was in my first year of law school, I took a course on real property, and loving math, I was very happy when I saw the chapter we were going to do was on Euclidean zoning, and so I think this is some wonderful mathematical theory on how zoning was done, only to find out when I studied it that it was called that because the seminal case in the early 1900s came out of a town in Ohio called Euclid, Ohio. And so it became Euclidean zoning. So not everything that appears to be mathematics necessarily is. This actually leads us into some of the other discussion. The readers are going through this, what ways do you think, what issues that you raise in the book do you think would be particularly interesting for an online discussion?
I think that one of the things that readers may find most fascinating is the discussion whether mathematics is an invention or a discovery. Namely, are mathematical truths out there somewhere, and we just discover those truths in the same way that astronomers discover a new galaxy? Or is mathematics entirely an invention of the human mind, and it has no existence outside the human mind? Believe it or not, but practicing mathematicians are still debating this question. Mm-hmm. In fact, there is a quote which I like to say, that most working mathematicians are Platonists, and I'll explain that in a minute, during weekdays, and formalists during weekends. And the idea here is the following. I mean, the Platonist view of mathematics after Plato is that mathematics does exist in some abstract world of mathematical forms, and we only discover things, and so on. The formalist view is, no. This all comes from the human mind. You just write down some set of axioms, and you can derive mathematics from that. You can change the set of axioms and get a different mathematics. In the same way that, you know, I can teach you how to play chess, I'll tell you the rules, we play chess. I change the rules, we play a different game. So there are these two views. Now, the meaning of that quote is that when mathematicians do their work, they have this feeling they are in contact with some existing reality, that mathematical truths are there and they just discover them. But when they are pushed on it, you know, from a philosophical standpoint, on weekends, they say, no, 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 I actually don't believe this. I'm a formalist. It's only in the human mind, you know, and so on. So I believe that this particular question is going to be an interesting question to discuss. And I discuss it in the book, and I come up with my own conclusions. And I know a good number of excellent mathematicians, in fact, better mathematicians than I am, that will disagree with my conclusion. And they come in both sides, actually. So I think that this could be an interesting discussion. Another thing that I think people would enjoy discussing is the relationship between logic and mathematics. And that Barber's paradox, which I read before, I mean, just gives you an idea of how, you know, logic can sometimes fail you, but you know, there is a whole school that says that all of mathematics stems from logic. That, you know, you just start with a few axioms of logic and you can derive all of mathematics from that. And I think that is also an interesting question to discuss. You know, the relationship between logic and mathematics. Is mathematics all coming from some logical things? I mean, just to give you an example of a logical axiom, which I believe I mention in the book, is, you know, if I tell you either the butler murdered the millionaire or his daughter killed him, and then I tell you the daughter did not kill him, then you absolutely have to conclude that the butler did it. And your conclusion is not going to depend on how old is the butler, what is the length of the nose of the daughter, or any other details. So, you know, there are some axioms of logic that, you know, you put down and they force you in a particular direction. Is mathematics stemming from something like that? Or is this more complicated?
To what extent, when readers are applying mathematics, just to think about your example, is that understanding of mathematics come just as much from eliminating possibilities that don't fit as discovering facts that do fit? And in your example, you started with a basic fact, and by process of elimination, if it could be, the answer could be A or B, and then you discover the answer can't be B, you know, you don't have to go further in understanding that it's A. In mathematics, to what extent in theoretical math are mathematicians eliminating things that don't work versus approaching it from the other side?
So in mathematical logic, I mean, that is what happens almost all the time. I mean, this is how exactly it operates and so on. But there are other areas of mathematics, you know. I mean, mathematicians sometimes formulate an entire new branch of mathematics that did not exist before. You know, when Newton wanted to describe motion, for example, he did not have a good mathematical tool to describe motion. So, you know, being Newton, he formulated a whole new branch of mathematics, which is the thing we now call calculus. And, you know, kids study that at school. And calculus was found to be a fantastic tool for describing motion. So, you know, in that case, it was not an elimination of something. It was, you know, the creation of an entirely new branch of mathematics that did not exist before.
It was interesting that one of our astronauts had the opportunity to do an experiment on the surface of the moon of one of Newton's theories.
He did this, Galileo is, according to legend, According to legend, Galileo did this experiment from the Tower of Pisa. In fact, as far as I could tell in my research, Galileo never did this experiment. But
the tower wasn't leaning quite as much.
It doesn't matter that the tower is leaning. but somebody did do this, but much later. So yeah, he did this experiment of, you know, dropping two things in a vacuum and seeing that, you know, if you drop a feather or and a hammer, they fall at the same time to the surface when there is vacuum. I mean, on Earth, of course, this is not going to happen because there is the air resistance, which, you know, slows down the feather. But you could make it in a vacuum tube on Earth, and you will see that they fall exactly in the same way. Right, so, yeah, one of the astronauts did that just to show, because the moon has a very, very dilute atmosphere, which is practically a vacuum.
But I think it probably, it's also an example of how someone can make that aspect of mathematics entertaining for the general public.
Of course, yes. Yeah, there are many entertaining aspects of mathematics, yes. People don't realize this, but yes. Well, I think that the barber example that I gave you is entertaining at some level, right? I mean, so definitely there are many entertaining aspects. I mean, popular culture, as you mentioned before, is often does not do a service to mathematics, because mathematicians and scientists in general in popular culture are often described like crazy people, that, you know, they are real weirdos that do all kinds of strange things and so on. And, you know, I know some people who are weirdos, but they are not necessarily mathematicians. I mean, you know, some of them may be, but certainly not all mathematicians are weirdos. And I mean, you know, one example I gave in a previous book was this very famous mathematician, Évariste Galois. He died at age 20 in a duel. You know, so, I mean, he was, you know, a romantic, you know, the romantic's romantic. So there are all kinds of mathematicians, like there are all kinds of people.
I'm reminded of a discussion when my daughter came here to Hopkins. And she was trying to decide whether to go into the applied mathematics program at the School of Engineering or the arts and sciences mathematics program. And so she asked what was the difference. And the department chair in engineering said, well, the mathematics department in arts and sciences tackles a very difficult math problem, and they spend the next 3 years trying to solve it. They come up with a solution, they all go out and celebrate, and then the next morning they come in and say, where's the next problem? And he said, we here in engineering say that you just got hired by a company who has 18 trucks, and they have to make 94 deliveries in the next 72 hours to 54 different cities. How do you route the trucks for the greatest efficiency?
Right.
And
that's actually a famous problem, you know, the traveling salesman and so on, yes.
So, you know, I think in a nutshell, that showed really two aspects of math that are both necessary in culture. Is there anything else, any other issues that you see that you think would be interesting for a discussion point?
Well, I think these are, you know, and plus the main theme of the book, which is, you know, how come mathematics is as effective as it is? And does it work in all occasions? What about biology? I mean, do you apply mathematics to biology? Do you apply mathematics to economics? You know, and so on. Could we have predicted the latest, you know, collapse of the entire economic system, or did mathematics in fact cause the collapse of the latest, you know, economic system, and so on. So I'm sure people, you know, will discuss some of these questions, and some of them are discussed in the book, not all of them, but people can, you know, also create their own subjects based on what they read.
If one of the readers was going out on a walk with their child, and they have just read this book, is there a nugget that they can keep in mind, just walking through nature, to try to spark an interest in mathematics with their children?
Well, there are lots, actually. I mean, they will look it up in the sky, and maybe the sky will be blue that day. And the reason that the sky is blue has to do with the way light scatters through the atmosphere, and it just so happens that our atmosphere scatters in a way that the somewhat bluer light, shorter wavelength, scatters more than the other parts of the light, and this is what gives the sky its blue color. They will look around them and they will see lots of symmetric things. And by that I mean both bilateral symmetry, like the symmetry of our face or of most animals, but they will see other symmetries, like the symmetry of a snowflake, which you can, you know, rotate in certain ways and it remains unchanged, and so on. All of those are described by mathematical theories. They can look at phyllotaxis, which is the arrangement of leaves on a stem. And it turns out that the way that leaves are organized, believe it or not, are such that they are organized in an optimal way that they will fill all space but without overlapping. Because if the leaves were overlapping, then it means that not all leaves will get the same amount of sunshine, you know, or rain and so on. So, you know, almost everything around you has some sort of a mathematical explanation at some level. I mean, there are things that are not explained in all details, but the theories that we have, they are generally mathematical.
So is there something else that you think the readers should focus on and be interested in knowing about this particular book, and perhaps even discuss how all four of your books explore different aspects of mathematics?
Well, one thing I think people hopefully will enjoy when reading this, I mean, I go through the history of great ideas about mathematics through history, and I go through some extraordinarily clever individuals and through their histories, and when I write books, I do an incredible amount of research, and I also very often like to actually travel to the places where these people worked. So some of that you will not, you know it just from reading the book, but, you know, I can tell you some things. Like, so for example, you know, I write about Plato. And I was very disappointed to discover that Plato's Academy, which was, you know, this incredible school where Aristotle was a student, you know, and so on, archaeologists were unable to find any remains from the Academy. But then, while in Greece, I did find that Plato mentions in several places this Stoa of Zeus, where he liked to walk, and so on. And I did find that in the ancient Agora in Athens. So, it was an incredibly hot day. I mean, it was close to 130 degrees that day. And I still kind of walked there, you know, back and forth and so on, thinking, aha, this is exactly where Plato, you know, used to walk. Then when I wrote about René Descartes, this famous philosopher, mathematician, biologist, everything, there are all kinds of interesting stories about where he was buried, how his bones were removed from Sweden to France and so on and this. And I said, well, I have to see his grave. And some of his remains, I mean, not the skull, are buried in the church at Saint-Germain-des-Prés. And believe it or not, you come to that church and you enter. And I asked somebody, where is Descartes' grave? And they didn't know. I said, how is this possible? This is one of the most famous philosophers, you know, and so on. And then I started looking. And eventually, on one of the, you know, these small chapels that they have along sides of churches, mm-hmm. on the right, I found that there, in one of these small chapels, there were three people buried. And one of them was Descartes. And there is even a sculpture there, which is not of the cult. It is one of these other two, you know, priests or whatever they were, you know, and so on. Which I thought was really just unbelievable. And it was so unbelievable to me that I actually told somebody about that there in the church. And last December, I was again in Saint-Germain-des-Prés and went in. And actually now, close to that chapel, they actually have put a sign that this is where Descartes' grave is. So there are all kinds of little things like this. You know, I wrote about Archimedes. Well, Baltimore actually is very lucky in that a very famous palimpsest of Archimedes was donated to the Walters Art Museum, and actually the deciphering work on it was done here at the Walters. You know, because I knew some of the people there, I got to see it, I saw them doing the work, you know, and so on. So, you know, that to me, this is very, you know, very beautiful to be able to actually see this palimpsest, you know, with Archimedes writing on it, you know, and so on. And this is, I really enjoy, you know, this part of the writing and so on. And I hope that it shows in some ways, even if I don't describe it in detail in the book.
That's wonderful. Well, Dr. Livio, I can't thank you enough for taking time to do this with us, and I know our listeners will enjoy hearing this discussion and reading the book. And I understand that sometime during the months of January and February, you will be posting some 6 questions on the website and be participating in an online discussion of this book. And I know the listeners will be looking forward to that. For those of you, we wish you a very happy holiday season, and thank you for, again, Doctor, for your time.
My pleasure.